Welcome to Business, your weekly business radio show. I'm joined in the studio with...
Good morning, University of Leeds students. This is Nabil Hassan speaking to you, and welcome to Down to Business.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Sean.
Good morning. I'm Tom, President of the Trading and Investment Society at Leeds University.
Awesome. All right. So should we get down to business?
Brilliant. Thank you, Edwin, for that lovely welcome. So we're going to begin today with a topic that our listeners probably must have heard of by now, Ebola. But here on Down to Business, we're not going to look at the normal number of how it's affected the society. We're going to look at through the lens of the big pharmaceutical companies and the economic incentives, i.e. profits, that they have to produce vaccines.
That's right. So, over the weekend, British pharmaceutical company GlaxoSmithKline stated that the development for a vaccine to combat Ebola is moving at a rapid pace.
But the world needed an Ebola vaccine months ago to stop the epidemic that has swept across Western Africa, yet none existed. Now, the race is on to develop vaccines in a matter of months instead of the years it typically takes. But even if one of the current candidates works, a few questions remain. How much is all this going to cost? Who will foot the multi-million dollar bill? When should they start production? And how fast can companies make millions of vaccine doses?
Well, to answer the first question, GSK's head of Ebola program has stated that GSK could produce up to 500,000 doses for $25 million, and that cost would drop with increased quantity. But the company does not have any reliable cost estimate for production at a larger scale, especially given that the fact that no one can accurately estimate how much is needed now or in the future, and what a vaccine's shelf life is.
So, Down to Business listeners, what do you think? Is there a limit that should be set on the cost of an Ebola vaccine production? How much is too much?
Why not take a wider overview of things? The World Bank estimates that the long-term effects on the economies of those in the region will be crippling. At its current rate, the virus will cause Liberia's economy to contract by 4.9% and reduce economic growth in Sierra Leone from 11% to approximately 2%. So the minimum finding amount should be the amount equivalent those economies have lost in value.
You know, come to think of it, Sean, what incentive does GlaxoSmithKline have to produce the vaccine regardless of this? I mean, from a cold-hearted or rational thinking economics point of view, when pharmaceutical companies are deciding where to direct their research and development money, they naturally assess the potential market for a drug candidate. And that means that they have an economic incentive, i.e. in their profit to shareholders, to target diseases that affect wealthier people, above all, the people in the developed countries, who can afford to pay a lot for the drugs. They have an incentive to make drugs that many people will take, and an incentive to make drugs that people regularly take for a long time. The current system does a reasonable job of getting people in the developed world drugs they want, albeit at high prices. I mean, what do you think about the underinvestment in Ebola, Sean?
Underinvestment in Ebola? Well, how about you, Tom? Not much to say.
Yeah, it's obviously going to be a trade-off between the companies in terms of their ethical overview of the situation, as well as, you know, they're there to make a profit at the end of the day. And it's obviously they're going to make a bigger premium in more developed countries with drugs that have been more readily tested. I mean, we heard from GlaxoSmithKline that the tests that are currently taking place for the Ebola vaccines they've got in development won't be finished until mid-2016 for when production can pick up to the levels that is required to sort of contain the disease within Western Africa as it stands, and so I feel that the company won't act in sort of the negative interests of their own shareholders just to prove some sort of ethical point, which is a shame, because as a humanitarian, obviously it would be nice to think that people could spare the money through research and development that they had from making profit elsewhere to be able to create vaccines for such terrible disasters as has occurred with Ebola.
So, Tom, I mean, that was a brilliant answer, by the way. But, I mean, as head of the Trading and Investment Society, how do you think that making a vaccine for Ebola would affect GlaxoSmithKline's stock market options? I mean, how would it affect their share prices?
Very limited effect, and hence why we're seeing sort of a delay to action there. The issue with trials as well of vaccinations is in order to test for side effects, they have to have a certain number of human guinea pigs as well, which mean that they have to pay for a lot of money in terms of their development of the vaccine, which will cost them a lot of, you know, overhead costs before they've even made any sort of premium out of selling the vaccines to, I don't know, humanitarian organizations such as, I don't know, who would be supplying the sort of the funding behind the vaccines that would go to West Africa. I think that's an issue as well. I mean, once the, if the disease became, I don't know, a little bit more widespread, say to more developed countries, such as we've seen cases in Spain, a couple in the UK, we've seen a few over in the south of, you know, the United States of America. I feel if the disease started to take hold in those countries, perhaps the incentive would then be there for GlaxoSmithKline to really sort of ramp up, you know, and speed up the production of the drug, which is a shame because, you know, obviously the people that are most in need are sort of out of reach at this point.
I completely agree. I mean, when you think about it, the World Health Organization calls neglected tropical diseases such as Chagas disease that affect more than 1 billion people and kill as many as 500,000 people a year. Yet, apparently, a study found that more than 1,500 drugs that came to the market between 1975 and 2004, just 10 were targeted at those neglected tropical diseases, according to a World Health Organization study. And, well, when the disease victims are both poor and not very numerous, that's a double whammy right there. But, I mean, from the sounds of it, doesn't this feel like a market failure? I mean, Sean, do you want to explain to our viewers, listeners, what a market failure is?
What you're saying now, Bill, describes a market failure. The market underprovides a good which has a potential for vast public benefits. The economic incentives, i.e. profits, for the production of these vaccines fall short of public health needs. Yet, if there were to be intervention in the market, which will encourage producers to supply closer to the socially optimal level, demand will be met and the epidemic could be contained.
Thank you, Sean, for the explanation about market failure to our non-economist listeners tuning in right now to Lead Student Radio Down to Business. Another question for you, Tom, regarding just pharmaceutical companies in general. Then, is there no incentive to cure, for example, to find like final cures for like diseases in general? Because pharmaceutical companies, if they did end up curing everyone, surely they'd just be out of business once they did bring in the cure.
It's certainly sort of a pharmaceutical paradox there. You end up curing everybody and then losing all of your market. There's always sort of the trade-off with pharmaceutical companies, and the way that pharmaceutical companies, you know, their share price is dictated tends to be through the patents they have on the drugs that they produce, often, you know, in vast quantities. Hence why we've seen recently that Pfizer wanted to take over AstraZeneca over in the UK because of their sort of the patents they have on the cancer drugs that they have in the pipeline. If you cannot patent a vaccine such as that which would be created for Ebola or any sort of other tropical diseases, which have been sort of left sort of malignant at the bottom of the pile, so to speak, instead of other drugs such as other sort of more topical diseases such as cancer, where everyone can sort of relate to and it does affect everybody all across the world. You see the patents drive the share price, and hence if they're trying to develop something that cannot be patented, then that will have little to no effect on their share price, and hence would reduce the incentive for them to produce these vaccines.
Sorry to stop you there, Tom, but just for some of our listeners who may not be aware of the definition, what does patented mean and why would it affect the share price?
Yeah, absolutely. So a patent is something that a company takes out on its intellectual property or something that it produces or a service that it provides that it feels is unique in the market and gives them some sort of a competitive edge in the marketplace. Things that have been patented in the past, there's certain flu vaccines, there's cancer drugs, and there's also stuff like your common day aspirin, other typical painkillers and stuff were previously patented and now obviously the patent runs out. So patents tend to have a lifeline, and with drugs it tends to be about 40 years. So a company would be allowed to produce the drug for a specific amount of time without any threat of competition in the marketplace, and hence they will have 100% of the market share on the consumers of that drug, and hence that gives them a great market price. If they're the first in the market with this drug, they have a strong patent in place. No one else can ramp up their production. No one else can copy their production, and so you're the sole seller in the market, which hence will drive your market share overall and will also increase your share price.
Interesting. You mentioned how aspirin and the patent for that had run out. So when I walk into Essentials, I'm looking at aspirin produced by Tesco, by Boots, by several other pharmaceutical companies. Is there any profit in that then, if the patent has run out?
Very minimal, but it's a case of a race to the bottom in that case. You'll notice that the price of paracetamol was about, I don't know, what, 25p a pack now? And that has shot down from, you know, that's the thing with a drug. Once the patent has run out on it, everyone comes to the market, produces a drug for cheaper. You have, you know, companies over in China mass producing this sort of stuff once the patent runs out. And you have a lot of predatory pricing in that sort of market, which is where, you know, producers will be looking to produce the drug at as low cost as possible to try and drive everyone else out of the market. And so you'll often find the price of drugs fall ridiculous amounts after a patent has expired. And hence, for those companies that previously held the patent, the drug becomes almost sort of null and void on their revenue and also their share price as well.
But hey, I mean, low prices, great for people like us, the consumers who need the Panadol to start their Monday mornings. But then why don't more companies, why do we encourage the use of patents in the first place? Surely it would make more sense for them to have a race to the bottom anyway, to have a competitive market. Why do you think that they do that?
Good question, Nabil. I think the main incentive here is for companies to invest. And we all know how much R&D costs. Sometimes companies invest billions and that drug ends up not coming to the market for whatever reason. So it's actually an incentive to allow companies to invest, knowing that their profits are protected for this period of time, and to actually allow that to see its way to the market instead of other companies sort of fighting for rights to produce the drug.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, that's loads of different views in the room here. That was a brilliant conversation, everyone. So next up, our topic is why decreasing food prices may not be good news for everyone. Now, for anyone following the trends in the global economy, or for those who aren't and just happen to be listening in, the slump in food prices may have caught your eye as peculiar. Now, people don't suddenly stop eating or lose their appetites. With more mouths to feed than at any point in history, why then have food commodity prices been decreasing so rapidly? Before we begin, I mean, Sean, do you want to explain what the term commodity means to our listeners?
Sure, Nabil. The term commodity is used to describe a type of good where demand exists for the item, but its content is difficult, if not impossible, to distinguish between different suppliers. The basic idea of a commodity is that there is very little difference between a commodity coming from one producer and the same commodity from another producer. For example, a barrel of oil is basically the same product, regardless of which oil company you choose to obtain it from. If you think about it, the type of mobile phone you buy could be generally be considered unique in the market, but a loaf of bread you purchase from Tesco's may not be at all that different from the one Morrison's is selling to you.
Scandalous over there. Moscow and Tesco and Morrison's having the same type of loaf of bread. Ooh, can't believe that. Thanks for the easy to understand explanation, though. Now, on to our question. Just why have food prices decreased so much? I mean, according to the latest edition of the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization Biannual Food Outlook Report, food markets and prices for most agricultural commodities, such as wheat, are sharply lower than they have been in recent years. I mean, it's been a combination. It's been a combination of things, I guess. The past couple of years have seen consecutive good harvest seasons, which have allowed stocks of food commodities to build up. I mean, if you include the fact that world wheat production is expected to reach new records and other crops not far behind, an excess of supply leading to price shortfalls nearly all over the world.
Well, that's all well and good, Nabil, but what about here in the UK? Have food prices been affected?
Well, it's not just the high productions that have led to lower food prices in the UK. It's considered with the supermarket retail war.
Supermarket retail war? What's that?
Well, it's not an actual war, but the supermarket retail battle, I should say, is where the big four, Tesco, Asda, Sainsbury's and Morrison's, are having their market share eroded by discount supermarket retailers like Aldi and Lidl to compete more effectively on price. I mean, supermarkets put loads of pressure on the suppliers, such as the people that supply the milk in large quantities to fill up their Tesco-branded milk cartons, to negotiate lower per unit costs considering the quantities that these supermarkets buy from them. They sell high volumes but on very small margins, and some producers, some products, they even sell them at a loss.
Yeah, I get what you mean. Pressure like that leaves farmers and crop producers with less and less revenue, despite more and more sales. But back to the supermarkets, why would they sell their products at a loss? These are huge businesses. Surely they must know better than that.
Well, I know that's the case, Sean, but actually, it's what supermarkets like to call loss leaders. Now, to our listeners, loss leaders is when supermarkets deliberately sell certain products that we buy every day at a loss. So, for instance, there was recently where they sold bananas below cost to attract different customers. They also tried to sell milk below cost as well, because it attracts customers to enter their store and then they buy other products with their shopping, obviously. And from that, once you're in the store, you're buying all these other products, and those products are being sold at a premium. And that's why they sell things at a loss initially, just to attract customers, really.
I guess it's also to retain market share, isn't it, Tom?
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting. There's a lot been done recently in studies into the psychology of sort of supermarket shoppers. And the big four have invested a lot of money. So, you know, you've got the largest retailer in the UK is Tesco's at the minute. Obviously, a dip in market share recently with all of its the troubles of its executive board. Its financial statements were pretty much fudged for the last 6 months, which is obviously not very good to hear if you're looking for transparency, you know, as a shareholder. But they've done a lot of work in terms of figuring out how people shop and their shopping habits, and often what you'll find is that they'll fill shelves with thousands of varieties of products that no one will ever actually buy, but it's to give this sort of impression that the customer is getting choice and value for their money as a result of that. And it's a very interesting concept, and obviously if you go to a budget retailers like Aldi or Lidl, you'll notice there are a lot less variety of products on the shelves, but the prices are a lot, you know, tend to be a lot lower than the rest of the big four. And that's sort of what's driving consumers towards these sort of discount retailers, as we now call them.
I know what you mean. I mean, Lidl, for instance, has been growing tremendous amounts year on year. Same thing with Aldi, whilst some of the big four have actually been losing market share. Just like, what makes the discount retailers such as Aldi and Lidl so attractive?
I guess what they began with to make their prices really low, if you see a difference between Sainsbury's, Morrison's, Tesco's, you put them into one bundle, what's the difference with them and Aldi and Lidl? You could see that Aldi and Lidl, they don't really have a lot of retails around, spread out around the UK, and these retails will add up to the really huge cost of their price per product. You compare that to like Aldi and Lidl, where most of their costs, everyone comes together in one place, really far away, really far from the city, and that makes it cheaper for them to produce anything. That makes it cheaper for all the lorries, their trucks, their vehicles to come in together to one place, get the stuff, sell the products. Compare that to having to go to many retails around the UK, and I think that's why it makes it more cheaper.
So Tom, if you were, let's say, the executive of one of the big four, what kind of suggestions or recommendations would you make for them to change perhaps their marketing mix, or what kind of strategy should they start employing to kind of re-establish that balance?
Certainly. Well, you can look at the strategy of, I think Tesco is a really, really good company to sort of analyse over the past couple of years. You notice that Tesco started off being just the supermarket, you know, that you would go to buy your whole week shopping. Then all of a sudden you move into convenience stores. You get Tesco Express opening up down the road. You've got Tesco Metro in city centres. You've then got them moving into banking, into phones, into book selling, games, you know, all of these sort of surplus goods. That it's really not what you see from Aldi and Lidl. Whilst you do see sort of aisles of kind of odds and bods, it's really not any sort of something substantial outside of that food retailing. They've really stuck to their guns very well, and that's meant that they've been able to attack Tesco and the big four on price point. So I feel
Tesco is kind of spreading itself too thinly and not
perhaps, yeah.
Behind.
Well, perhaps. And the thing is, what the Big Four did originally to try and combat the budget retailers was push this sort of brand, you know, the branded goods.
Yeah.
So they've all got brand match or, you know, some sort of coupon where if your branded shopping was less expensive at another Big Four, they would sort of give you the sort of the difference off and trying to give you incentives. So obviously you've got the Tesco Club card, or you've got Nexa card at Sainsbury's. So they try and draw you win in other ways, and also with quality as well. They tried to sort of appear that the products that were on sale at the big four were in somehow, you know, a better quality to those that you could find at Audi and Lidl. And that's not really worked for them, because Audi and Lidl have proven sort of time and time again with some of these sort of quality, you hear about these quality awards, like Audi's Christmas pudding was apparently the best Christmas pudding at 31 different retailers last year, which included Waitrose and M&S. And so I feel some sort of back to basic strategy for a firm like Tesco. I think spinning off something like the Tesco Bank or their insurance you know, businesses, maybe cutting back on the mobile phones deals, just really getting back to what the customer wants, which is a cheap shop for a week shopping. If we're seeing, you know, real wages fall as well, there's a pressure on people to put food on the table.
Corey, interested to see what your opinion is on this. How would online retailing kind of affect this business? Do you think that they have kind of fallen short of improving their online supply systems, so that people know that you don't not only have to walk on, but then they can target the customers even before they walk through their doors?
No, it is an interesting point, actually, and it was interesting, I think, to see Morrison's strategy on this. Morrison's held out, so they weren't going to give some sort of online retailing option, and then all of a sudden, bang, Morrison's complete change of strategy, giving an online retailing offer to the customer, giving delivery and stuff. And I think the issue with online retailing is you don't see the variety of products in front of you, whereas if you're actually shopping for the physical good, you can quite comfortably compare the prices across a broader range of goods that they have in the supermarket, as I explained earlier, with sort of the supermarket psychology kind of strategies.
I mean, this isn't a new problem. I mean, John Lewis, a few years ago, they had the same issue. Their profits were falling, market share was falling, and well, the problem was, and what they ended up, the way they solved the problem is that they ended up closing many of the stores throughout the UK and then focus more on online retailing, and that was a huge success for John Lewis, the John Lewis partnership. And you know, when you think about it, going back to supermarket psychology, something about spending money here, when you're spending physical pound, when you have notes in your hand, you're actually less likely to spend compared to when, for instance, you have a prepaid card, or when you have like a debit or credit, when you're using a debit or credit card. So in a way, almost, when you're online and then you see all these products just on your screen, and because you're so far away, you're not actually giving them physical money, you're just making the payment online, that might actually encourage consumers, or people like everyday people like you and me, to actually spend more on these supermarkets on food that we don't require. I mean, just the other day I was shopping on Tesco online, and I was just looking at all these different deals they have on, and I was just like, yeah, I could do with a bit of shower gel here, a bit of, you know, box of chocolates over there. I mean, you know, why not? Obviously, that isn't advocating the particular website of Tesco.
Speaking of online shopping, Amazon has recently launched its Amazon Prime, which is supposed to compete with Netflix in the streaming movies and television area. So, as was last reported, Netflix has about 32% of the market, whereas Amazon has 19% and Hulu Plus has 9%. So I'm quite interested in seeing how this develops as time progresses, because obviously people are moving off from their television boxes to the online space. So Tom, what do you think Amazon's approach has been? Like, how have they managed so quickly to develop their own TV shows and to take shows like Game of Thrones and Boardwalk Empire? How have they managed to compete with them so quickly?
Well, I think the thing with Amazon is that their sales revenue is very, very impressive, and their capitalization as well. And so they've got a lot of money to play with, and they've chosen to invest it in the tablet market, chosen to invest it in their online offerings, which is obviously where Amazon, you know, was born out of, was the ability to deliver anything to any part of the UK the next day. I think they've really sort of delivered on that with their online package in terms of what you can get on their tablets and what, and they're now bringing out obviously a phone as well, which allows you to scan the media straight to your phone and be able to buy it straight from the Amazon store. So I think things which are sort of multi-channel is what everyone's looking at now, increasing the shopping experience to being out on the street, being able to scan something straight into your phone, being able to buy it, is similar to what the QR code tried to do when that first came out. So I feel we'll see a lot of sort of multi-channel offerings from a lot of players. in the market.
That's what Google is trying to do with Google Wallet. Apple as well are increasing Apple Pay. So we're going to be seeing a lot of these mobile synchronized payment platforms.
Definitely. And it'd be interesting, you know, we talk about supermarkets a little bit. It'd be interesting to see if the supermarkets sort of catch on to that and try and incorporate that perhaps in some of their strategies going forward, which is something that probably Aldi and Lidl wouldn't have to do because they're arguing on price point. But the big four might have to look to some sort of offering like that.
More creative ways.
Thank you very much, Tom. That was Down to Business. We hope you guys enjoyed the show, and we'll see you again next week.